As you saw on the signs coming in, as you, I hope, noticed in the brochure that you got in August, and you may have noticed again in the postcard that you received in advance of this particular program, which is the first of this season, this event is dedicated to Bob Link for 3 years as president and many years as a loyal shareholder and board member of the Athenaeum of Philadelphia. He has been president during my 2 3/4 years, and I have found him to be a spectacularly loyal, generous, wise, and good-humored partner. Join me in saluting Bob Link. We're in for a terrific evening. Rachel Slade is at least in part a Philadelphian, and so this is at least, in a manner of speaking, a return home. She's lived in quite a few places, but Philadelphia was one of them. She got her political science degree from Barnard and a Master of Architecture from Penn. And she is a journalist working on stories about politics, design, technology, and other subjects. After a decade working at Boston Magazine, she joined the Boston Globe editorial staff in 2017. Her articles have appeared in Esquire, Hemispheres, the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, Architecture Boston, and other journals. She recently wrote about an astounding new mind-reading device being developed at MIT. She has earned national recognition for her work, including a Civic Journalism Award in 2014 for an investigative story on the Boston Redevelopment Authority. Now we come to the subject of tonight, her extraordinary book, Into the Raging Sea. I have been reading the New York Times for probably more decades than I ought to confess, about 5.5 or 6. And I've been reading the book pages of the New York Times for all those years. So I have read thousands of book reviews over all those years, including a couple of my own, which were good and bad by turn. I don't think I've ever seen one book reviewed 4 times by the New York Times unanimously with applause. What's the it book of summer going to be? Rachel Slade's Into the Raging Sea, Tina Jordan of the New York Times. For sheer drama on the water, it's hard to beat the tragedy recounted in Rachel Slade's Into the Raging Sea, Janet Maslin, New York Times. A powerful and affecting story, beautifully handled by Slade. Douglas Preston, The New York Times. It makes for an exciting, terrifying, and deeply sad story, Gilbert Cruz, The New York Times. It's a remarkable book. It's gotten national attention, all of it positive. And I think it's a real treat for us, and actually in many ways we're lucky to have the opportunity tonight to meet with Rachel Slade, who we'll talk about Into the Raging Sea. Rachel.
Thank you so much. It is incredible to be in this absolutely beautiful space, this historic space. What a wonderful way to come back to Philadelphia. My parents still live here, but I usually just skip town and go to the suburbs. So it is good to be here. And before I start, I also wanted to mention that there's somebody very special in the audience with us tonight. This story is about a ship and a hurricane, and that ship was built right here in Philadelphia in 1974, and we are very lucky to have a gentleman who built that ship. John Glanfield is here with us tonight with his wife, Dot. John. John was an invaluable source to me as I was working on this story. Just incredible to be able to connect with the history of the ship, the history of shipping, the history of shipbuilding in my hometown. It was terrific to be able to know you better, John. And it's a friendship that I hope lasts beyond this book. I also wanted to say that it's rather eerie to be meeting tonight. I've been speaking all summer, and of course I never thought that I would be speaking just ahead of an enormous hurricane that is about to pound South Carolina. And it feels eerily familiar when you understand Joaquin, which was the hurricane which sank El Faro. So just in a nutshell, I'm going to tell you the story. This looks like a place where you would tell ghost stories in a way. And I will tell you the story of El Faro, but just briefly in a nutshell. And let me just ask, can everybody hear me okay? Is the sound okay? No, we have a no, we have a crank it up, Rachel. We have another crank it up. I feel like I'm auctioning. Do we have another crank it up? Okay. Is that any better? Okay. I will try to enunciate and speak slowly. Anyway, it's strange to be able to be talking about ships and hurricanes as this new hurricane, Florence, is about to pound the South Carolinian coast. And so I wanted to, if you wouldn't mind, this is something that I don't usually do, but I wanted to read very briefly from a chapter that I wrote about hurricanes as a prelude to this story. It's chapter 5. This is going to be very short. Don't worry, I'm not going to do a lot of reading. A hurricane is not a point on a map. A hurricane is not a point on a map. It is not an object that exists in space and time. Rather, it's a huge catharsis, a brief explosive event when nature's forces combine to spin off the ocean's heat into wind. Over its brief lifespan, a hurricane expends the power of 10,000 nuclear bombs. It's a spectacular display of thermodynamics in a complex, evolving, moving system. Like a cancer, a hurricane is a lethal distortion of the stuff of everyday life. The Earth's winds harmlessly swirl about us, creating patterns in the clouds, kicking up waves for surfers, nudging planes around the globe. All these heavenly movements are tendrils of much larger systems, like the jet streams that forever flow easterly, caught up in the rotation of the Earth. Thanks to the jet stream, winter storms will always pound New England in February when Arctic air from Canada drifts south over the plains, gets swept up east in its current, and is carried to the warmer air over the Atlantic Ocean. Although the Earth's meteorological picture is as vast as the planet itself, it is very sensitive, prone to disruption, fickle. A butterfly wing-like change in pressure, temperature, in one place can cause a small piece of the continuum to break away from the mainstream like a recalcitrant teen. It often fades into the ether, but sometimes, when conditions are right, it can escalate exponentially, causing astounding damage to anything in its path. Every hurricane begins as an atmospheric low or depression in the bottom layer of the Earth's atmosphere. The low acts like a vacuum, pulling up warm, moist air from the ocean, which spirals around it in a counterclockwise direction in the northern hemisphere. If conditions are right, plentiful, warm, humid air, the currents corkscrew upward around the low pressure zone at increasing speeds. Feeding on the temperature and humidity differential between the hot ocean and the chilly upper atmosphere, the tropical storm thrives. Air currents around the center pick up heat, and with its speed, as the center's pressure drops even lower, intensifying the cycle. Warmest climes, but nurse the cruelest fangs, wrote Herman Melville. September 28th, 2015. Charlie Baird was a mariner. He had been a mariner for decades. He lived in Portland and had been sailing on again, off again, 70 days on, 70 days off, for 35 years. He was getting older. It was hard. Working as a merchant mariner is not easy work. You have intense moments loading, getting off the dock, and then long stretches of boredom as you stare out to sea. It had been hard for Charlie, too, because when he was away, on those times that he was away, his marriage started to fall apart, and he drifted away from his wife, and then he drifted away from his daughter. And these things were heavy on him. On September 28th, he had stepped off El Faro in Jacksonville just a week before. His replacement, as second mate on the bridge of the ship was Danielle Randolph. She was 30 years his junior, and like him, she was from Maine. They had been swapping back and forth as second mate for several years. But Charlie wasn't sure she was doing okay. It seemed that the weight of the job was taking her down. She was pounding coffee and Notos to stay awake, and she was taking ZQL to fall asleep. The strange cycles that are demanded of the mariner were making her rethink whether or not this was the right career for her. And besides, as a young woman, she was finding it very hard to keep a relationship on shore. What was her future going to be? So that morning, Charlie woke up in his house in South Portland, Maine, and he did what he always did. In his bathrobe, he sat down on that sofa and turned on the TV. And where did he turn it? He was a mariner. What do mariners look at? The Weather Channel. Anybody who's a mariner knows that mariners live and die by the weather. And even after they retire 10, 20 years out and say they're living in Arizona, hundreds of miles from the nearest body of water, they still know what's going on in the Atlantic. They still know what's going on in the Pacific. They will call each other and talk about the weather. And that's just what Charlie was doing that morning. He sat on his sofa, and what he saw, he didn't like. There's a tropical storm out there. It was brewing off the coast of the Bahamas. And if it kept going west and south, it would cross the line where El Faro, his ship of many years, was destined to go. It was a milk run, a typical run, between Jacksonville and Puerto Rico. It carried everything Puerto Rico needed for daily life. It carried $25 million worth of goods, including cars, trucks, bicycles, dolls for children, refrigerated cars filled with frozen chicken, produce. All of the goods that El Faro carried would supply Puerto Rico for the weekend. Those goods, as soon as the ship arrived, would be removed by longshoremen and then taken to Walmarts and Targets and groceries all over the island. It was critical to the life of the island that El Faro arrive every single week. And now there's this storm brewing. Charlie starts watching the storm, and he starts thinking about Danielle. And then he does something that he had never done before. He picked up his phone, and he texted Captain Michael Davidson. He wasn't friends with Captain Michael Davidson. He didn't know him that well. They both were from Portland, and that's about as much as they had in common. But there was something that made Charlie pick up the phone. Now, the other thing I want to mention is that, like baseball players, mariners are extremely superstitious. And Charlie, to this day, still can't tell me why he did this. But he picked up the phone, and he texted Captain Davidson, and he said, "There's a storm brewing out in the Atlantic." And then he waited and watched the Weather Channel. Davidson, of course, was on the dock in Jacksonville watching his ship being loaded. And a couple hours later, he wrote back, "Yeah, I know." Charlie wrote back, he said, "What's your plan?" And Davidson said, "We're going to just shoot right down. We're just going to shoot right down." So Charlie watches that Weather Channel, and around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he's not feeling good about this. So he texts Captain Davidson again. Now remember, this guy is off duty. He should be sailing his boat, but he's worried. So he texts the captain, and he said, "I just wanted to remind you that there are outs. There are places that you can go if you feel trapped by the storm." Because the trajectory of the ship between Jacksonville and San Juan, Puerto Rico, takes you right out into the Atlantic Ocean, and the Bahamas, which we think of as just small islands, a chain of small islands, is actually an enormous shallow plateau, which is completely impossible to cross if you're a deep draft vessel like the 790-foot El Faro. It has a 33-foot draft. You cannot cross the Bahamas. So if you find yourself trapped out there and a storm is pushing you in toward the Bahamas, you have nowhere to go. Except there are a few natural deep channels that cut through the Bahamas. And every mariner who sails down there knows about them. And Charlie reminded his captain that they existed. And in fact, just a few weeks before, a storm had come in, and Charlie had convinced the same captain to take the safe route and go on the lee side of the Bahamas, and they avoided the storm. And it's possible, although we don't have evidence, that the captain was chewed out by the shipping company because of the delay and the extended trip and the use of fuel and everything that goes along with making the safe decision sometimes. So the captain wrote back later, Captain Michael Davidson, and he said, "We'll be fine." And then Charlie did what every New Englander does. He wrote back to Michael Davidson and said, Sox are up on the Yankees 2-1. I know I'm in Philadelphia, so that doesn't always go over. And Michael Davidson wrote back his final words, "Go Sox." That ship left that night and traveled into the morning. And Charlie was back on his sofa the next morning. Now we're on Wednesday morning. And he watched that storm grow. And that storm defied all forecasts. It blew up into a Category 3 hurricane in no time. It refused to cut north and continued on its southwest trajectory at an astoundingly slow, creepy 5 knots per hour. Now, you're going to see that again when you watch Florence. You may have seen the New York Times story about how hurricanes due to global warming are moving slower. And the explanation is very simple. It used to be that oceans would get hot from the sun hitting them throughout the summer. So the top level, the surface of the ocean, would be very warm, and that's what would feed hurricanes. And as the hurricanes stirred up the water, they would stir up the cooler water below, and that would push them along in search of hot water, their food, their fuel. But in this case, the oceans have absorbed so much heat over the past 40 years that there's an incredible depth of heat from which a hurricane can pull. And so hurricanes are slowing down. They have no reason to move along. They're slowing down, and that causes major problems, as we'll see. Charlie's watching the storm, and he's freaking out. He calls up his friend, who was a former chief mate for El Faro, and he's down in Florida, and he said, "Do you see the storm?" And they talk. We found out later during the investigation that nobody from the shipping company was following the storm at all. The next morning, Charlie wakes up early. Sorry, let me just mention, he figured out how to track El Faro. Anybody can. All commercial ships, all those tens of thousands of ships out at sea, all have something called AIS. It's a GPS system, essentially, for ships. They communicate through satellite, they record their position, and you can go on to vesseltracker.com or marinetraffic.com, and you can follow them, too. You can go anywhere in the world and see all of these ships, and you can click on them, find out where they're going, where they're flagged. And so Charlie figured out how to follow El Faro, and he saw that she had not changed course, in spite of the fact that this storm was escalating. He wakes up the next morning and checks his GPS, checks the tracking, and it says, "El Faro, last known position." And he refreshes it. "El Faro, last known position." And it never changes. It stays the same throughout the day. Actually, could we have the recording now?
I just need your name, please.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Michael Davidson. Michael C. Davidson.
Your rank?
Ship's master.
Okay, thank you. Ship's name?
El Faro.
Spell that? E-L?
Oh, man. The clock is ticking. Can I please speak with a QI? El Faro, Echo Lima, Space, Foxtrot, Alpha, Romeo, Oscar, El Faro. What's your position? Okay.
Okay, in case I lose you, sir, what is your phone number, please? Hi, thank you.
Wait.
Just really briefly, what is your what is the problem you're having?
I have a marine emergency, and I would like to speak to a QI. We had a hull breach. A scuttle blew open during a storm. We have water down in three holes with a heavy lift. We've lost the main propulsion unit. The engineers cannot get it going. Can I speak with a QI, please?
Yes, thank you so much. One moment.
Sorry, every time I hear that, sorry. 33 minutes later, the American government's network of hydrophones in the Atlantic Ocean picked up an enormous thud just beyond Crooked Island in the Bahamas. It was a sound rarely heard out there in the deepest part of the sea, where for decades the government had been recording an endless underwater symphony. 3 miles down, they listened to the lonely cries of humpback whales, the eerie hum of earthquakes, and the whir of submarine propellers. Just white noise, really. But that morning, something huge and audible hit the ocean floor with terrific force. Based on the position of the hydrophones, the people listening knew approximately where the object had landed. They also knew the precise moment that it hit. But what was it? That the Americans had been listening in on the ocean since the 1960s was no secret, at least not to mariners. Some older guys remembered laying down cable decades ago to feed this equipment, which served as the first line of defense against submarine invasion or other nefarious activity on the high seas. The precise locations within this network were considered classified, but one monitoring station, known as AUTEC, occupies a piece of Andros Island in the Bahamas, just west of Nassau. The thud was notable enough that there was talk among a few members of the armed forces stationed down there. That intel simmered among a handful of officers assigned to monitor maritime activity in the Caribbean. When word got out that a large American ship had vanished in Hurricane Joaquin, somewhere east of the Bahamas, those stationed on Andros Island knew exactly what they'd heard. It was the sound of El Faro colliding with the ocean floor. The loss of El Faro was the worst American maritime disaster in more than 35 years. We lost 33 people in this ship. Because of the loss, it triggered an enormous investigation, jointly run by the National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard. We got incredible information from that, and a lot of that, of course, is in my book. But what was most astounding about this investigation was that they were able to recover the ship's black box. The story of the recovery of this black box is incredible in and to itself, and I don't want to spend too much time going into it now. But remember, this ship was 15,000 feet down. It was deeper than the Titanic. No human could go down there. And so it took 3 missions and more than $3 million to recover this ship's black box, which is this big. I've held it in my hands. I went to the National Transportation Board. I've seen this thing. They used robotic vessels, tethered. They sent it down. They were finally able to unclip the thing from the mast of the ship. The robot dropped this device into a basket and brought it back up to the surface. It had taken El Faro probably about 4.5 minutes to sink. And as she sunk, she was shedding everything aboard. Those shipping containers, the cars, the trucks, the bicycles, the dolls. So by the time she landed on the ocean floor upright, she was surrounded by a debris of modern life that was sitting quietly now on the ocean floor. And when the researchers were sent to find this small black box, they had to pick through all of this debris miles around this ship to locate this thing. And it's kind of incredible that we have it. But what's even more incredible is what was on it. They took this thing back to the National Transportation Safety Board in Washington, D.C., and they carefully unscrewed it, and inside was a motherboard, and on the motherboard was a chip, and they still didn't know what was on that chip. So the technician plugged it in and started listening. He went straight to the end because he wanted to make sure that he had the right voyage. And when he started to listen, he knew he had. It was chaos. So he rewound it. 26 hours. We have 26 hours of conversations on the bridge of this ship leading up to its very final moments. It took 1,000 man hours to transcribe this document. It took several people in a room listening with headphones, winding and rewinding and rewinding because they did not want to misquote the dead. And what we ended up with was a 500-page transcript, which I used in the book. So all of the conversations in the book are actual conversations between the men and women who are on that ship. And what did we find? What did we learn? We found out that maybe we shouldn't have such faith in technology, for one. Aboard that ship were two weather forecasting systems. There was the National Hurricane Center system that came in through a dot matrix printer. It was alphanumeric code, and any fans of Edward Tufte here will understand what I'm about to talk about next. When you get alphanumeric code, you have to actually plot information. And so what was coming in every 6 hours was the storm's location, its projected location, and a bunch of numbers that talked about sea height, winds, more predictions. Somebody actually had to sit down and plot that. On the other hand, there was this other weather forecasting system, which we know that Michael Davidson much preferred. It was a third-party system called Bon Voyage. I'm going to call it BVS, Bon Voyage system. It was beautiful. It looked a lot like Google Maps on your car. So it had GPS, it knew where the ship was, and you could program in where you wanted it to go, and then it would overlay incoming weather information, which got uploaded every 6 hours. It would overlay that weather information onto the map and told you exactly where the storm was going to be and exactly where you were going to be. So you could click through an hour later, tomorrow, the next day, and you could clearly see, just like on Google Maps, if you ever drive with Google Maps, where you would be. And Captain Davidson was assured by this technology that he would arrive in San Juan at 8:01 on Friday, October 2nd, and he stuck with that to the end. The picture that BVS showed was of this ship going on its pretty much normal route and a storm moving north and west. In other words, he could skirt right under it, which was his plan the whole time. While aboard, there are dozens of conversations between the ship's master, Michael Davidson, Danielle, the second mate, the chief mate, the third mate, as well as the helmsman aboard, wondering why Bon Voyage system didn't line up perfectly with what they were getting from the National Hurricane Center. This is about uncertainty. How do we talk about uncertainty in the 21st century? It's not that easy. The National Hurricane Center, it turns out, had no confidence about its forecast for the storm. They knew that there was an incredible amount of uncertainty because they were using many models to try to understand what the storm would do. And it was defying their forecast. And they admitted later on that this was actually one of the most difficult storms that they had predicted in the past 20 years. In fact, the National Hurricane Center is probably the only government service which actively tracks errors, their own errors, so that they can improve upon them, but also so that they understand predictability and uncertainty. So the National Hurricane Center was sending out its forecast alphanumerically. The ship's officers were dutifully plotting the information, and yet the captain was following a completely different set of forecasts. Actually, they weren't quite so completely differently. It turned out that the Bon Voyage system, which he depended on, was actually a repackaged National Hurricane Center forecast. In other words, National Hurricane Center forecast would come out, say, at noon, and he would have access to that. But the Bon Voyage package, which came out at noon, was actually based on the National Hurricane Center that a prediction that had come out 6 hours before. So his national, so his BVS was telling him a forecast based on data that was more than 12 hours old. And you can imagine in a very quickly evolving storm, those hours are critical. Why couldn't his officers convince him that what they were looking at was right and his was wrong? It seems nobody understood why BVS was so consistently wrong in such a consistent way. It continued to show the storm backwards, a little further back, a little further north. It was lagging behind their National Hurricane Center information, but they couldn't quite understand it. And for my final passage, I just want to quickly read you what it was like on that ship in the storm. Are you okay with me reading something? Okay. You're on the ship. I'm going to take you onto the ship. Now remember, I did not make up any of this dialogue. This is all real. This is from the transcript of this black box. Chapter 14, Night. El Faro was small and alone in a vast black emptiness, shrouded by Joaquin's mile-thick clouds. The few lights on the ship's console were like cold, distant stars. A laptop-sized radar screen regularly burst into silent fireworks representing the agitated surface of the sea. Another screen tracked the ship's position, their intended course, shown as a simple, straight line. The instruments would reveal other vessels in the area, too, if there were any. "We don't have any options here," said Third Mate Jeremy Ream to his helmsman, Jack. "We got nowhere to go." "Jesus, man, don't tell me anymore. I don't even want to hear it," Jack told him. The two men stood behind the console, squinting into the abyss. Invisible waves pounding the vessel's port side bullied her into a long, slow, rhythmic side-to-side roll, not enough to make them sick, but enough that as they walked around the bridge, they ran their fingertips lightly along the grab bars to stay upright. Small things began to shake loose and slide across the desktops onto the floor. Anybody below who was awake flicked on cabin lights and stowed away pens, coffee cups, and eyeglasses in drawers and cabinets. The distant hum of the engine far below was the only source of comfort, like a heartbeat. Just before midnight, Danielle entered the bridge in a flood of light. "Good morning, Danielle," Jeremy said. "Good morning," she said, closing the bridge door softly behind her, sealing the engine room once again, sealing the navigational bridge once again in the heavy gloom. She approached the console. Jeremy winced in the darkness. He wasn't sure he wanted to leave the helm to his fellow officer. So many things could go wrong. But he wasn't sure he wanted to stay either. After experiencing hours of anxiety, he was mentally exhausted. Jeremy picked up the wax pencil resting on the plexiglass protecting the paper chart and used it as a pointer as he spoke. "This is our latest course," he told Danielle. They would travel 32 miles to the next waypoint, a predetermined coordinate that marked their course, which put them right on track to meet the storm, if the NHC's forecast was correct. The NHC weather report that came in at 2300 was different from BVS, Jeremy noted for the 1,000th time. "I told that to the captain, but this is the course he wants." "This is totally crazy," Danielle said, once more breaking into excited, uncontrollable laughter. Her one consolation was that in her lifetime, no American ship had gone down. Ships sometimes got caught in vicious storms, but they always made it. They'd be okay. They'd be all right. A lot of people ask me why I wrote this story. It's an age-old story. Ship stories, shipwreck stories, journeys, going all the way back to Odysseus, the Bible, Noah. We have Herman Melville, one of my favorites, The Tempest, Shakespeare. This is an age-old story, man against the sea, against nature, with a uniquely 21st century twist, in that we know exactly what happened. So what does it take to sink a ship? There are many answers to that. And when I was working on this story, I actually liked to think of the working title as 1,000 Little Mistakes, Big and Small. There was certainly corporate greed, tremendous amount of pressure on the captain, as always, 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 to get that ship in on time. Otherwise, you lose money. In the transcript, we read so much about middle-class fear. Because if this captain had lost his job through error, forced error, or decision-making error, he might not have been able to find another. He had two girls in college, two BMWs in the driveway. He was mortified with the idea that he might not have a job in a couple of months. It's also a story about climate change and the very difficult process of now forecasting storms that are behaving differently than we have ever seen before. And finally, it's about the incredible pressures that the global economy is putting on our teeny tiny merchant marine. There was a time when the merchant marine, the American merchant marine, was the pride of our country. Now, our merchant marine makes up only 2 to 3% of the global fleet. And the reason that's important is because I want you to think about something. During World War I, we had very few commercial ships that we could call our own, that were registered here, that were owned by Americans. During World War I, when we needed goods shipped out or when we needed goods shipped in, we relied on foreign power. And we got gouged. Prices went way up. And that's why they created the Marine Act of 1920, which called for the building of ships and the building of America's merchant marine so that we would never be beholden to foreign powers again to move our goods and to survive. We think of ourselves as connected by the internet. We think of the web as connecting all of us, when in fact, that's only partially true. What connects us is shipping. If you look around the room and you look at yourself, everything that you wear, probably almost everything in the room minus the historical stuff, has spent some time on a container ship. These are the people doing this work, and they're in danger. And that's what I learned while working on it. So thank you very much for listening to me, and you've been a wonderful audience. Thank you. And I'd be happy to take some questions. It's 6:12, so if anybody has any questions. Yes, sir. We haven't. Thank you. So the question is, did the black box reveal how the ship went down, why the ship went down? We have excellent intel on that. And I don't want to get too technical, but in a nutshell, that ship was perfect when it was built by John in the audience. It was designed in the 1960s, before containerization. So now when we think about global shipping, we think about these huge ships, right? With these containers piled high on their decks. That's how we move goods. In the 1950s, and of course throughout time before that, goods came in different sizes and weights, and you had to really think about how to load ships. It took a lot of time and a lot of mental energy. The El Faro was built as kind of a hedge between the age of longshoremen and packing a ship and the age of containerization. It's called a roll-on, roll-off, row-row. So the design of the ship was, it's funny for me to talk about it here because with John in the audience, because I'm like, oh, he's fact-checking me. Generally, the ship sat rather low, and the idea was that trailers would be driven onto her deck and then down ramps into her belly and locked into place. So the containers, these trailers, these, you know, tractor trailers, were kind of acting like containers. So you could load up the tractor trailer on shore and then just drive it onto the ship. That meant that there were very large openings that were rather close to the waterline, which is fine. The ship was stable. The ship was then lengthened. So she was lengthened 90 feet to become 790 feet, which is ultimately where she was. But in 2003, the owner of the ship, Tote Maritime, which is a division of a multi-billion dollar logistics company privately owned based in Seattle, wanted to do something else. They were asking El Faro to do something else. They wanted her to take containers on her deck. So they requested of the Coast Guard that they make modifications to the original ship's design so that she could take now weight up high. Now think about this, you've got a slender ship, a lovely ship, a ship designed for one thing, and now you're changing her dynamics, and you're changing how she's going to perform in difficult conditions. And the captains who I spoke to and the captains who testified who had sailed these ships said that when you added the weight up high, when you started running containers on her, she was tender, which means she was sensitive, which means she was slower to right herself. And so what they did was they actually built in safeties. The captains themselves decided to do this. They limited how much weight she could take, and they conferred with each other and set standards because they were concerned about the stability of these ships. Again, since John is here, let me say again, they were perfect when they were built. And all of those ships survived. There were seven of them built, I think, the Ponce de Leon, is that right? They were all fine. The El Faro was the only one that we lost. So now she's carrying more weight above, and she has these large openings that are close to the water, and for some reason during that time, her load line was raised 2 feet, 2.5 feet, which meant that then she was taking on even more cargo. So she was more loaded on that trip than probably ever before. So what we know is that she's no longer stable, right? She's taking load the way she wasn't designed to. She has large openings, and on top of everything, the crew is getting complacent, and it seems that someone left a hatch open on the deck, the main deck. These ships, the main deck is actually partially enclosed. There's the top deck and the main deck. The main deck is partially enclosed. So when the water washed in, it would get trapped on the main deck. And because the bow and the stern were slightly higher, again, John, correct me if I'm wrong, the water would pool right in the center, and that's exactly where this open hatch was. Nobody knew the hatch was open. And in fact, we now have proposed safety standards that would put very simple alarms on these hatches, because almost every shipwreck you ever hear about started with an open hatch. A ship is like a Tupperware container, right? Like if the lid is on tight, you can't sink it no matter how much you want to. But once you let water in, it will sink like a stone. So the ship's buoyancy depended on being watertight. Water starts to come in, the ship starts to sink lower. And then it turns out that she had another vulnerability that very few people understood, although John did. The huge cargo spaces below were designed for cars and trucks, and so they needed to ventilate those spaces. And so there was a very large ventilation system on this ship, and it meant that there were these ducts that were under the top deck, which then went down deep into the belly of the ship, like a big giant straw going from above the waterline deep down below the waterline. What we found out was that these were probably highly degraded over time, rusted out. But the captain also didn't understand that these were vulnerabilities. These were points of entry. Ship is now sinking lower in the water because she's taking on water from the open hatch. Now she's moving from side to side because she's getting closer and closer to a storm, a Category 3 storm, and then suddenly her ventilation shafts start scooping up water, spelling doom. She had so much list by 6 a.m., 1.5 hours before she disappeared, she had so much list that the engineers were having trouble with their lube oil pressure. So another design, I'll just briefly explain the lube oil system. I feel funny explaining a lube oil system to y'all, but the lube oil, so this enormous machinery that drives a steam engine is bathed in an oil system, which requires 1,200 or so gallons of oil running through it. So it runs through all the gears, and then it collects at the very bottom of the engine room in a sump pan. It turns out that the suction pulling the oil up to keep it circulating was off center. When you have a list, the oil moves away from that suction bulb. The engineer was having trouble getting his lube oil up. Why? Because he was running that ship at very low lube levels, and because he was dealing with an incredible list. And eventually, he lost propulsion. The thing seized. The whole engine stopped. And anybody who knows anything about ships and storms, if you lose your ability to control the direction of the ship, you are lost. And that's when the captain called the emergency call center, and that's the call that you heard. Thank you for your question. No, there were no survivors. There were 33 people aboard, 28 Americans and 5 Polish workers who were getting the old ship ready for her final run in Alaska. So no, there were no survivors. Yes, sir. Lifeboats. Okay. So if you go on a cruise, many of you probably do cruise, hopefully you will see enclosed lifeboats. They're bright red, right? They look like the yellow submarine, but they're red. And they're kind of snub-nosed things. The El Faro had the same life-saving equipment that she had been built with. Open lifeboats, just like on the Titanic. They were relatively easy to deploy in no weather. But in a hurricane with 130 mile per hour winds, you couldn't even stand on that deck to launch them, let alone try to get in them. And if you did try to get in them, there is no doubt that they would have swung back against the hull and smashed to pieces, which is what we saw. So no, there were no enclosed lifeboats, which could have saved mariners' lives. Yes. Julie. This is my mother. Yes, thanks, Mom. One of those moments. You raise an excellent point. In the age of sail, it was an incredible job, an incredible honor to be an officer aboard a sailing ship. It required a tremendous amount of knowledge. Usually you came from a New England family who was involved in the trade, and you got shares in the voyage. So the original merchant marine, or you know, in the colonial days, you had a stake in the outcome of the voyage, and you could work your way up from cabin boy at 12 years old to ship owner by the age of 40. So you were invested. Nowadays, of course, we think of our captains and our sailors as truckers of the sea. They have highly specialized knowledge, but we don't see them. We don't think about them. And it's not an easy life. And I think the question is, you know, what have we learned? Are these people going to be safer now? Laws take a long time to change. We just saw the duck boat tragedy in Branson, Missouri. I'm sure many of you saw that. Do you know that it's a repeat, almost exactly, of another duck boat incident in which 9 people died in 1999? I mean, history repeats itself again and again until we figure out how to make things safer. And I think the laws are slow to change. We now have the Maritime Safety Act of 2018, which addresses many of the problems that we discovered in the investigation of El Faro. But mariners are now keeping the story in their hearts. They're thinking a lot about the lessons learned. And so I think that everybody's a little more alert than they used to be. Schools are now actually teaching the story. I just found out that SUNY Maritime, which is one of our 7 maritime academies, will be teaching this book. And so people are thinking about it. And that in itself begins to make things safer, because we need to be vigilant. And we can't forget that Mother Nature, you can't mess with her. Yeah. Yeah, good question. So the question is, if the weather system had been accurate, would they have survived? What really were the causes of this accident? I mean, the El Faro was an accident waiting to happen. She was in bad shape. The crew was ill-equipped. They clearly didn't understand weather forecasting. They didn't understand what it means to be in a Category 3 hurricane. I mean, all of those things are factors. Now we also have a captain who's somewhat dictatorial and refuses to let go of his mental model of what is going to happen to him based on technology. And so, of course, I can't tell you whether or not, you know, they would have survived if they had different weather forecasting, but they probably would have. And yes, BVS has been sued by the insurers of the cargo. So the families have all settled. That's another story. They all settled for about $500,000 each. We're talking about people who lost their children, who were 23, 24 years old. There was one young man from Maine Maritime Academy. This was literally his first ship, his first job. He stepped on that boat and he was gone. So we had people young, we had people old, and all the families settled. There was not a lot of money offered to them because of admiralty law. The laws that determine, that, you know, define what happens at sea and shippers and all that is completely separate from land law. It's its own specialty. And so this fell under the law of limitations, which meant that the company was only responsible for reimbursing the families as much as the ship's hull, just the hull, was insured for, which in this case was $25 million. That had to be divided among 33 families. The history of the law of limitations, just an aside, came from the 1860s. Yeah, it's that old. And it was because when ships went out to sea, there was no contact. And so if a ship never came back, whose fault was it? Nobody knew. And so instead of allowing shipping companies to just go belly up when everybody came looking for reimbursement for their losses, this law was created. So it's made to protect shippers. Let me just check the time. Yes, sir. Right, so the question is, has anything been done to change the 12-hour gap between the two systems? Well, first of all, anybody who knows anything about this story knows now that BVS is lagged. You know, it's based on lag time. They're also being sued. I suspect that they're probably going to tell their clients more explicitly that this is merely one forecast based on older data, and you should always double check with the National Hurricane Center. But that was not clear in the interface that Captain Michael Davidson was using. Yes, sir. Why did I write this story? How could I not? I mean, a shipwreck, right? I didn't know that was possible. I've read Moby Dick 5 times, you know. I've read all these beautiful ship stories, incredible ship stories. And here in 2015, one was handed to me. And not only a shipwreck story, but one that had people I knew, people I could reach out to. And the story of the mariners themselves told in their own words, you know, thanks to the black box. So How can I not? Thank you very much.